From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Ryan Nurz has a conflicted relationship with marijuana. He's regularly smoked pot since college, but he never thought of himself as one of those baked slacker types, more like a productive stoner. But at some point he began to wonder if he was just rationalizing. Was he addicted, or was this good for him in some way? Did it make him more creative, or was it screwing up his lungs and his memory and his motivation? Nurz decided to write a book about not just his conflicted relationship, but the country's itself. Part of the project included putting a bunch of pot in the trunk of a rental car and driving cross-country, which he admits now wasn't such a good idea, but along the way he learned a lot about marijuana in America. He'll join us today to talk about it, the history, the economy, the good stuff, and the bad parts of our favorite illegal drug. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When the journalist Ryan Nurz started researching America's conflicted relationship with marijuana, he realized it mirrored his own relationship. So his book is surprisingly personal and candid. He confesses his affection, his love of pot. He also wanted the book to be participatory. He wanted to get inside the narrative, he says. So he ended up putting a bunch of marijuana inside the trunk of a rental car and heading cross-country. When he looks back on it now, it may not have been the best idea, but he did learn a lot about what he's come to call marijuana America, the culture of weed in this country, the history, the public policy, the propaganda that comes from cannabis advocates to the hysteria you hear from the anti-pot crowd. Nurz was looking for a middle ground. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about his book. It's called Marijuana America, One Man's Quest to Understand America's Dysfunctional Love Affair with Weed. Ryan Nurz is a freelance journalist. He's written for NPR, for Esquire, for the History Channel. And he's also the author of the book Eat This Book, A Year of Gorging and Glory on the Competitive Eating Circuit. Ryan's joining us today from NPR member station WFYI in Indianapolis. And Ryan Nurz, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot, Doug. Good to be here.
Well, let's start. I guess it is the most compelling kind of provocative way into the story, and that is the kind of your project that you call the first chapter of your book The Lamest Looking Outlaw, where you're talking about transporting this pot across country. Let me ask why it is you decided to do that. I mean, as a concept, because you talk about wanting to get inside the narrative, and this was in part, I guess, a way to do it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, what happened was, you start with a sort of plan of what you think the book is going to be, and I thought, I'm going to go and I'm going to explore both angles of it. I'm going to go to marijuana anonymous meetings, but I'm also going to go and hang out with artists who say it's, their creative fuel. Yeah. And you have all these plans, but then, when it really came down to it, I did a lot of things, in the beginning of the book. I went to meet a guy down in Florida who is one of only four people in the country who can smoke anywhere and gets 100 joints of weed from the federal government. Yeah. I went to Oaksterdam University, which is a cannabis college, and these were all kind of interesting and cool, but I was feeling like what really is happening in American marijuana culture because of the sort of contradiction of laws between the medical marijuana states and the federal government, mm-hmm. and the non-medical marijuana states is all happening. All that culture is really happening behind closed doors, people sort of sneaking out back and people driving clandestinely across the country. And one thing that I could not have predicted was that I met this guy who in the book I call Buddha Cheese, right. who is a sort of, yes, marijuana kingpin. And he offered me the opportunity to drive across the country, and he also had bought a bunch of books for me in his little bungalow in Northern California, which included a bunch of Hunter S. Thompson books and other sort of gonzo journalism, and it seemed like the right thing to do at the time. I'm not sure I feel that way now, though.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the fact that the project is first person, is personal, that you didn't intend it to be that personal, I guess, when you first started either, I guess. Or did you?
Well, I did on the level of, the way this came about is you mentioned my other book, Eat This Book. And, yeah. That was my first sort of venture into narrative nonfiction.
Right.
And I was writing about the International Federation of Competitive Eating, for whom I worked, and I was an MC, and I really couldn't get into the underbelly of it. I couldn't, you know, I was writing for a company that I worked for, and so at that time, I was also spending a lot of time alone. I had a breakup, and I found myself smoking marijuana, not so much just to enjoy it, but to sort of escape and to just sort of feel normal. Yeah. And then I really started thinking about, well, what's going on with America? I mean, you know, it very quickly, Google searches led me to the fact that, you know, we are the most enthusiastic pot-smoking nation in the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, people think about the Netherlands, but we crush the Netherlands. We crush every country.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, so what's going on here? You know, I mean, you know, alcohol is there and it's legal. Is that, why is that not our sort of self-medication or Prozac or Ritalin or whatever those prescription drugs that are legal? Why are we going to this illegal drug? And I just kept exploring. And I did want to make it personal, even though that is a little uncomfortable, but I found times in writing it that it really didn't work, and other times where I felt like it worked well, and I think kind of brings the reader into my story. Yeah. And America's story.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about this. You write about this precise moment. I mean, you can absolutely pinpoint the moment when you started doing weed full time. This was you're in a parking lot in Indianapolis. This is the winter of 1994, and this seemed like a kind of an important moment in some ways for you.
That's right, Doug. And you know, I think that, you know, it was both an important moment, and one of the things I try to point out in the book is that it's a totally banal moment.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just literally sitting in a car. I was playing junior hockey. I was taking a year off from Yale University, trying to figure my life out, playing junior hockey, and sitting with another guy from my team who was like, you got to listen to this song. And it's a song by The Far Side. And it's a, you know, it's basically a hip hop song about marijuana.
Yeah.
And it is very orally and musically very, very layered. And there's all these different sounds that come in from different angles. And there's a guy who coughs, and the cough becomes an instrument. And I just was absolutely enraptured. I thought, I have never heard music like this before. And at that point, you know, I went from being totally concerned about my life. I wasn't happy with college. I wasn't happy with hockey. I was pre-med at that point, and I hated pre-med. And I was sort of alone, and all of a sudden, I didn't care about any of that. Everything was flushed away and was replaced by every instrument and lyric and part of this song. And I fell in love.
In the early days of your relationship with weed, I mean, you mentioned in some ways, you know, going overboard. You created, this was interesting, a privately defined world. This is a term from the group Marijuana Anonymous. What does that mean? Are you kind of, self-delusion, I think, is part of this period of doing pot? Or, I mean, explain what that is, privately defined world.
Sure. Well, you know, I think that was actually, you know, as I was doing my research, as I said, I was, you know, writing this other book and getting this other book out, and I was starting to get a little, you know, obviously writing is a very solitary task, and I was getting very absorbed in myself.
Yeah.
And part of that was smoking quite a bit of marijuana, and I've always been a more active smoker. I mean, I would smoke and go play sports and do stuff like that, but for the most part, this became a period where everything was happening in my head. And to the extent that, like, you know, my own self-referential jokes I would say to people in conversation, and they'd just sort of stare at me because I was like, oh, you haven't been there for the joke that I've been telling myself over
right.
and over.
Right.
And, you know, and a lot of, you know, what else would happen? I mean, you know, I had a point where I had a friend, and we had had this sort of, I had said this thing to him at a party, and I thought it had really angered him, and I thought that it was like sort of a deal breaker for our relationship. And I called him 2 weeks later to apologize profusely and say that I didn't mean it, and he had no idea what I was talking about.
Right.
So, you know, and I think that, you know, I did go to Marijuana Anonymous meetings, and
yeah.
It was the type of thing where I think a lot of people don't even realize that exists. You know, they know Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous, but they think, well, marijuana, it's just, you know, you're a pothead, get over it.
Yeah.
But you go there, and there's people who are really struggling with their lives, and they are really self-medicating. and they sometimes really revert inward. And you know, the most negative cliches come to mind and are real, which is, you know, that sort of sitting on your couch playing PlayStation over and over and over with Cheetos dust on your chest. Mm-hmm. And that's real. And I think that that's one of the things I wanted to bring out in this book is that, you know, there's people like Snoop Dogg who show weed to be so cool and he's always so happy and fun. And then there's other people who are sort of struggling in isolation. And if you put him in front of a woman who he really liked, would just flee the room. Mm. And go back to his PlayStation. And I think that it's important to point that out as well.
Yeah. Well, let's talk. You write about the history. Is this a weird question? When did marijuana get here? Like, has it always been here? I mean, you write about, we'll get mm-hmm. to this idea of when marijuana as a drug sort of arrives, which is around
sure.
like 1900. But as a crop,
right.
you know, as a weed.
Well, it has really. If you look back through culture, I mean, there were... you go back to the Scythians. They claim that the Chinese are really really where hemp comes into history.
Yeah.
They used hemp clothing. They found hemp fibers in old Chinese tombs. Then the Scythians were sort of the first ones to use it for spiritual means, as we understand it. They would take a bunch of hemp plant, cannabis plant, and seeds, and put them in a tent. And for things like rituals, like burials and things like that, they would all go into the tent and absorb this smoke and come out, and they would dance and they would sing and they would commiserate and rejoice. But you know, if you look at the Hindus, I mean, the Hindus have a long, long relationship yeah. with marijuana, and they've called it the seed of wisdom, the plant of enlightenment, and their words for marijuana and cannabis have always been very positive, as opposed to ours, pot, weed, yeah. obviously very negative connotations, and in other cultures. It's not looked upon that. And Islamic culture, obviously, in the Quran, you know, the alcohol was prohibited, but it never specifically prohibited cannabis. So there's quite a bit of cannabis use in Muslim history as well.
Well, you mentioned the Buddha himself went on this one hemp seed a day diet at one point.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So, essentially the only religions left is Christianity and Judaism. Really, really don't make much place for marijuana.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, the Buddha himself, you know, had a period where he was, you know, as he was seeking enlightenment, went on a one hemp seed a day diet. And I'm not sure he was feeling the psychoactive effects of that at that point. But then again, if you have that small of a diet, it's possible.
But in the United States, I mean, it's important to say that it was... It's been used to make fabrics and twine and parchment paper. It was, I guess in some ways, on that level, it wasn't that big of a deal for a while.
That's right,
yeah.
Doug. If you look back in American history, first of all, you know, pro-pot people, stoners and such, always love to point out that, you know, one of the drafts of the Declaration of Independence was written on hemp paper. That the Betsy Ross's first flag was made out of hemp, and there was a drive during even after Prohibition in World War II. It was called Hemp for Victory, and they had actual advertisements on the radio, Hemp for Victory, because all of a sudden this plant that we had prohibited, we realized that it was a very useful plant. It's kind of similar to cotton. But it's a little bit stronger, more durable than cotton, more breathable, and it's a great fabric. It also is used for oils and other things. But as far as marijuana itself, there were pretty much all the major pharmaceutical companies. Eli Lilly, right here where I am in Indianapolis, mm. had an asthma cure. They had a pain cure, a sort of a palliative. Pretty much all the major pharmaceutical companies before the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937, they all had medicines that use marijuana because it's been proven in all the way back, as I said, I mean to Chinese history. There it was in one of the original Chinese books of pharmacopoeia, and up till around the 1930s, when Harry J. Anslinger, who I call the Darth Vader of dope, decided that it was this terrible demon weed.
Well, let's talk about the movie Reefer Madness. It was a film made by the government to basically warn about the dangers of marijuana. Now, that film was made, I think it was 1936, and it's interesting because it wasn't the only one. I mean, there were several in this genre at the time that Harry Anslinger helped create, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, Anslinger, to his credit, he was very persistent when he decided that he had an enemy to focus on. And you know, came up in the government in the prohibition unit of the federal government, and he realized that if you can create a public menace and really stir up a public frenzy, that more than anything, you know, people think that he really hated this drug and really believed what he was doing, but more than anything, he just knew that that was a way to get money into his coffers during a time when, you know, basically the Great Depression was hitting, and that worked very well for him. But yeah, his onslaught was intense. I mean, he joined up with the Hearst newspapers to create this, you know, articles about, you know, black men in the South were smoking marijuana and having having orgies with white women, that Mexicans were becoming bestial demoniacs, I think was the word that he used, with a mad lust to kill. And then there were all these movies where, I mean, they're frankly, if you've seen them now, you know, they've re-released them in a very campy form because they're hilarious.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, you know, white teenagers get high and all of a sudden they're running around the room and killing each other and having sex. It's just meaningless.
Well, here's a clip, as a matter of fact, because this is from Reefer Madness itself, where this school principal is sitting down with this FBI agent to talk about the marijuana problem in the community. And essentially the agent is talking about how there's little the government can do about it, you know, but it's this growing, very, very real problem. Here's a clip from Reefer Madness.
In 1930, the records on marijuana in the Washington office of the Narcotics Division scarcely filled a small folder like this. Today, they fill cabinets. All these devoted to marijuana records. Here is an example. A 16-year-old lad apprehended in the act of staging a holdup. 16 years old and a marijuana addict. Here is a most tragic case.
Yes, I remember. Just a young boy. Under the influence of the drug, he killed his entire family with an axe.
Then there is the most vicious type of case. Here, in Michigan, a young girl, 17 years old, a reefer smoker, taken in a raid in a company with five young men. Here is a particularly flagrant case.
Yes, I remember. The newspapers made quite a play of it. In West Virginia, wasn't it?
Yes. And there are hundreds of them coming up, new ones every day.
Were they making stuff up? Was any of this true?
My understanding is that a lot of it was absolutely fabricated.
Yeah.
That said, I think there were a few cases where, you know, they were able to pull the thinnest thread of reality. And you know, there was, you know, somehow a marijuana joint found at the scene or something like that. But for the most part, it was – I mean, even if you hear that, he said, and the newspapers really, really picked up on this one.
Yeah,
that's because the newspapers were in cahoots with the same people making the movie, you know?
You know, the big question is – let's come back to – you talked about, for example, Anslinger talking about Negroes, Hispanics, Filipinos, entertainers who are marijuana smokers. And that seems to kind of get at, in some way at least, this initial resistance from official America to pot, because it was associated with foreigners and these fringe musicians, you know, basically Mexicans and blacks in many ways. And you're right about the fact that during the California Gold Rush, Chinese immigrants, they were also demonized for introducing opium into the country. So a lot of this is about race, I guess.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Doug. And there was that the Chinese precedent with opium, and basically, as I said, you know, I was sort of introduced to marijuana through music. I had that moment of being like, oh, this is incredible. I was able to sort of enjoy music in a new way. And that's exactly how America was introduced to marijuana, was really if you look at the nexus of it, they claim that it came up from Mexico through into Texas around the turn of the century. And it sort of moved into New Orleans, was really the epicenter of it, because a lot of jazz musicians who essentially, you know, were generally black, they played at brothels, they played at honky-tonks, and this was a place that was a intermingling of different cultures. And there were, you know, Cajuns and blacks and Latinos and Mexicans all together in this one place. And one thing they started to share was marijuana, and jazz musicians started to realize that, you know, heroin made them sleep, made them tired. You know, cocaine made them a little too aggravated and overwhelmed. Alcohol made them, you know, out of it. And the one thing that they could take that could relax them and get them into the moment and really feel the music was marijuana. And if you look at, you know, there's comments from Hoagy Carmichael in his biography. Louis Armstrong was a famous proponent of marijuana and smoked it throughout his life. All these jazz musicians basically really, really enjoyed the drug. And then as jazz sort of crept up the Mississippi River into Kansas City, Chicago, et cetera, marijuana started to suffuse a little bit more of the culture. But it really didn't hit that much of mainstream white culture. It was just something that was Harry Anslinger used as a tactic to say that it was coming, and right. Kids were starting to use it. But it was a very, very small subset. And it created a big, big fear.
So before we head to a break, just say something, if you would, about that where we get this federal law against marijuana, the Marijuana Tax Act. This is 1937. And it's so curious how the bill passed. I mean, you say it was late on a Friday afternoon. It wasn't even a vote taken. You say a clerk was just sort of counting the number of congressmen who walked by them. So say something about that, if you would.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's absolutely right. You know, and there's, once again, you know, when you really dissect what happened, there's a lot of conspiracy theorists in the sort of pro-pot realm, and I try not to get too into that. But, you know, Anslinger was definitely in cahoots to some extent with Randolph Hearst, who had big interests in the timber realm. I mean, he had all these newspaper companies, and he had a lot of timber interests, and he didn't want hemp to take over as something that fought, as something that battled timber for paper. And then there was also DuPont was another one that was in it with Hearst, and so Hearst had a lot of powerful, basically sort of lobbying interests that were, you know, that had their tentacles in Congress, in the Senate. And when it came down to it, if you really look at how that vote took place, it was definitely everyone sort of wanted it to just fall under the rug. Even the name marijuana was used for the first time. Before that, it was always called hemp. And Harry J. Anslinger started using marijuana because it sounded more foreign. It sounded Mexican. In fact, it is a Mexican term. And, you know, and he was even – there was a doctor who came on during that proceeding in the Senate and said, you know, this is all very manipulative. I've never heard this called marijuana before. I only know of it as hemp. I don't see any particular – you know, I don't see it inducing violence or anything like that. And he was silenced, and the vote went through, and it has been illegal federally ever since.
Ryan Nurz is with us. He's the author of the book Marijuana America: One Man's Quest to Understand America's Dysfunctional Love Affair with Weed. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about marijuana with the journalist Ryan Nurz, who's been writing about what he says is America's complicated relationship with marijuana. On one hand, you have the pro-marijuana folks who won't admit the downside, The anti-pot folks can be pretty hysterical, too. Nurse is looking for the middle ground. Along the way, he writes about the history of pot, the economy, the good, the bad. So one of the questions you ask in the book and you get at is, why is America among the highest per capita, if not the highest, cannabis-consuming nations in the world? And you get at this question about whether or not, which I found interesting, there's a kind of deeper cultural phenomenon going on, that Americans smoke pot because we're trying to rise above, you know, the soulless consumerism, because we're such a frantic capitalist kind of country. What do you figure you learned about that part of the story?
Well, I'm glad you picked that up, Doug, because that was initially one of my main concerns, my main interests in this was that, you know, okay, so if I'm using this at this point when I was really interested in this topic, if I'm using this, you know, so vehemently, and I almost need it, and it becomes, you know, there's questions about whether it's addictive or not, but I think that it was at least becoming somewhat of a compulsion, and I was really wondering, well, why, you know, why not alcohol, why not you know, Prozac, why not something else, or why not, you know, why isn't there some other substitute? And I really felt like one of the things for me was that I lived in New York City, and it was constant text messaging and phone calls and emails and interactions, and everything felt kind of frenetic and very secular.
Yeah.
And to me, what I could do was I could go off into my room and I could smoke, and for a half hour, I wasn't thinking about bills. I wasn't thinking about some fight with my girlfriend. I wasn't thinking about anything with my job or my writing. I was just listening to music and enjoying my life. And you know, you end up, I would end up sort of focusing on these minute little details and decide that they had this sort of greater beauty than I had noticed before. And so I do think that there's an element that Americans right now in contemporary American culture are turning to marijuana because, you know, alcohol, what it does is just sort of dulls your senses. Mm-hmm. So you basically just get a reprieve, and you just sort of get to check out and be kind of silly and kind of, you know, you get to kind of let go. But I think marijuana has a little bit of an element where you do engage. You engage in a different way, and it is a perspective-altering drug in a way that alcohol and I think probably some of the prescription drugs are not. Mm. And I do think that we've arrived at a moment in American and probably global history where, you know, people are looking to things like yoga and meditation and marijuana and other forms of when you do have that moment to, you know, sort of check out of the click and clack and the cars and text messages, and you want to actually have sort of an experience where you transcend the secular world. And I think marijuana actually has the ability to do that if used correctly.
Mm. It's hard to draw any conclusions from the scientific studies about marijuana. I mean, you've got some who say it makes you euphoric and imaginative. You have others who say, no, it makes you paranoid. Some say it gives you energy. Some say it makes you sleepy. In the book, you say if you really look hard enough, marijuana can be whatever you want it to be.
Exactly. Absolutely right. I mean, that is it's funny to engage with people who feel really strongly one way or the other, because, as you said, I mean, you can prove anything. You can prove that that it's really bad for your lungs and your respiratory tract. You can prove that it helps with asthma because it is a bronchodilator, and it was used as an asthma cure by many companies like Eli Lilly and Park Davis back in the day. You can prove that there's studies that say it causes cancer. There's studies that say it absolutely can help cure cancer. There's studies about driving on marijuana. And right now in Colorado, where they just legalized recreational marijuana right near you, you know, there's a big to-do about what is going to be a DUI. And there are actually studies that say people under the influence of marijuana can drive better than people who are sober. So you can drive better. You know, it causes all kinds of accidents. It's basically, it can be whatever you want. But when it comes down to it, I did arrive at probably about maybe, you know, 5 to 10 things that I feel comfortable saying that it does do. But for the most part, a lot of it, because so much of the research has agendas attached to them, it's very difficult to absolutely definitively say much of anything about its effects.
It's interesting. I mean, you learned that some of the advocates of the cannabis movement, they don't even like you using the word drug.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I went to Harborside Health Center in Oakland, California. It's the biggest medical marijuana dispensary in the country. It's basically the biggest purveyor, sort of legal purveyor of medical marijuana in the world. And when I began talking to Steve D'Angelo, who's the owner of it, his publicist, she really rejected my use of the word dysfunctional. She rejected my use of the word weed, the word pot, all because in their eyes, as part of this crusade, they're trying to, with words, shape the way people think about marijuana. And frankly, for their objectives, which is to continue selling to 100,000 patients, and make quite a bit of money, about $20 million a year, for their objectives, they absolutely should continue to shape the way people think about it, because the truth is that it's worked. I mean, you know, a lot of anti-pot people have been saying from the beginning, you know, this medical marijuana thing is complete, you know, complete crap. What they're really trying to do is it's a Trojan horse to legalize it fully and to make people see it in a positive light, and to see, you know, old aging women who have aches and pains, or someone with cancer who's using it. And then once we have that foot in the door, then we'll blow it open and legalize it outright. And I think there's some truth to that. And
that's frankly, it's working.
It's kind of working. Yeah, it's working. Exactly.
Let's talk about there are some great characters in the book. Steve D'Angelo is one of them. Interesting guy. This terrific knack for branding and publicity. Irv Rosenfeld is great, too. Let's talk about him. He's one of – this is strange – one of four people in the United States who is allowed to legally smoke pot in the country. Talk about Irv.
Sure. Irv. I'll talk about Irv. Irv likes to talk about Irv, too.
Yeah.
No, he's awesome, though. I mean, you know, I knew that I wanted to talk to him from the beginning because – you know, I had really been searching for characters. I'm always very interested. I think that, you know, as I said before, you have this plan, you want to do all these different things, but really you find the characters that work best and you stick with them. And Irv was one of them. And he has a very, very rare bone disorder that essentially he's growing tumors on his body all the time. And it is a polysyllabic word that I need not repeat. But basically, it is a terrible disorder. And he worked very, very hard under the tutelage of another guy who had glaucoma and worked very hard to petition the federal government to give him medical marijuana. And what he had to prove was that there was no other drug that effectively treated glaucoma. And then Irv had to prove that there was no other drug that effectively treated this bone tumor disorder that he had. And it took about a decade. He used his nephew, who was at the University of Virginia Law School at the time. And in the end, shocking everyone, including himself, he actually won. And ever since then, for about 25 years, he has had 300 joints shipped to him per month in southern Florida, right near Fort Lauderdale. Mm-hmm. He's a successful stockbroker. And when all of his stockbroker buddies go out to have a smoke break, he goes out and smokes a joint. And it's very strange because you hang out with Irv. I hung out with him at a marina. He owns a boat. He's a big sailor. And he's sitting there. There's kids running around, and it's sort of a family atmosphere. And he's just sitting there very flagrantly smoking a joint. Yeah. And it's, frankly, pretty unsettling. At the same time, you know, maybe it's a picture of what could be the future.
You mentioned, you know, get into the question of public policy, sort of where we are, and you talk about how so-called progress for legalizing marijuana hasn't really been consistent. It continues to have these setbacks. It kind of lurches forward, I think is how you put it in the book. And you mentioned,
sure,
President Obama's stance on legalizing marijuana. I guess he just doesn't really address the question, even though he has been the first president to openly talk about the fact that he used marijuana when he was younger. But you say that this is kind of a trend for politicians who, on one hand, they want to be perceived as being liberal about it, but then on the other hand, they kind of go the other way, and then they really crack down on the so-called war on drugs, I suppose.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, Bill Clinton with his famous, you know, "I didn't inhale" line. That was for someone who, you know, who was a sort of lone bastion of liberal policy there for a while. That was the death knell for him being even vaguely liberal. I mean, he was debatably worse than both George Bush's in his policy of cracking down incredibly heavily on marijuana. Obama has kind of made a nod towards the possibility of opening things up. But in his first term, and his first term was going on while I was writing this book, and we talked about Steve D'Angelo. At that point, right after I interviewed him, the IRS came after him for millions of dollars, and then they shut down Oaksterdam University. The feds, the DEA, shut down Oaksterdam University, which is a cannabis college that I had studied at. I don't think my parents were quite as excited about that as when I graduated from Yale. but no, I mean, you know, the federal government really, during the first Obama administration, they really went after California particularly. And then there's some other cases. There was a case in Montana of a guy who was absolutely had a legitimate, under state law, totally legitimate medical marijuana facility. He's now has a 5-year prison sentence. At first, it was going to be something crazy like 80 years, but he got a plea deal down to five years. And Obama his administration really went after marijuana. And I think that a lot of people have been thinking, well, okay, now he's in his second term, he doesn't have anything to prove.
Right.
He's got some leeway. But I think that what often happens is that if you're trying to get through things like immigration and healthcare, then you don't want to take a hard stand on something that a lot of people sort of brush aside as a joke. And I think that's one of the things that I really tried to bring up in this book, is that for so long people can brush aside marijuana as this sort of Cheech and Chong joke and this thing that's no big deal. And it's like, okay, you can't really be a weed addict. There's no such thing as Marijuana Anonymous. It's a bunch of stoners giggling on a couch, but really it's been totally suffused into our culture. So many movies now, address marijuana as if it's almost like taking a sip of Cabernet. Mm. And it's and so many people, I mean, if you go to almost any high school in the country, it's easier to get a bag of weed than it is to get a 6-pack of Coors Light, because it doesn't require an ID, and it's all happening on the black market. So I think that what Obama's doing right now, where he basically flat out said earlier this year when Colorado and Washington legalized recreational marijuana, he said, "I have bigger fish to fry."
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's certainly true on some level, but at some point the country has to realize that we are the most enthusiastic pot smoking country in the world. It is our biggest cash crop, and it's a pretty big fish to fry. And and it's also in a time of recession and a time where we're constantly talking about budgets. Why not tax and regulate our biggest cash crop and control it in the way that the Dutch do? I mean, people think it's totally legal in the Netherlands. That's not true. They're very pragmatic people. They're like the Germans. They take it and they say, "We're going to put it over there next to prostitution. You can do it over there. If you come out here, we're going to throw you in jail. But we'll put it over there and we'll regulate it and we'll tax it." And I think that there's something to be learned from that, and something that America could follow.
Yeah, you can't as a tourist, you can't wander around the Netherlands smoking a joint.
That's right. And another thing, Doug, is that, if you look at one of the things there's been a study by a guy out in California recently studied basically the perception of prevalence of marijuana among teenagers.
Yeah.
And in America, it's upwards of it's upwards – it's from like 50 to 70%. When you go to the Netherlands, they say that if you ask kids, you know, can you score weed? And they say no, because they have very stringent laws that it all remains within this system. And, you know, there's a lot of people saying that, you know, that's what is happening in these medical marijuana states, that, you know, there's sort of a trickle down and people, kids are getting more access to it. But the fact is that in America, kids already have access to it in absolutely non-medical marijuana states. And the Dutch have a much, much lower percentage of at least the perception of prevalence, whether that's actually true or not. So I think that there is something to be said for that. And like you said, you can't just walk around and smoke a joint in Amsterdam. You can't do that. You have to do it within the confines of this construct that they've set up, the coffee shops.
Yeah. Ryan Nurz is with us. He's the author of the book Marijuana America: One Man's Quest to Understand America's Dysfunctional Love Affair with Weed. And we need to take another brief break, so we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Ryan Nurz, the author of Marijuana America: One Man's Quest to Understand America's Dysfunctional Love Affair with Weed. So you write about sort of where we're headed, the question of what happens if it becomes legal. You say the legalization of marijuana is imminent, but it's interesting. In the book, you say it's not because we'll be taking this more liberal perspective necessarily. You say we'll eventually change because cannabis is a weed that can be grown anywhere, and it's just not practical. You can't really contain it.
Exactly. And, you know, the difficulties when Harry J. Anslinger actually, effectively made it illegal in 1937 with the Marijuana Tax Act was they had crews and crews. I mean, there was lots of money plugged in. They literally had to go to, you know, Kentucky had a huge hemp industry, and they had to go and burn all these plants everywhere. I mean, it's called weed for a reason.
Right.
It is a very, very effective plant. It grows at all different types of temperatures, all different climates, and it's very difficult to stop. And now, you know, that we have 18 medical marijuana states, two states that have legalized recreational marijuana. Mm-hmm. It's even harder to stop, because what's happening is, especially in the wild, wild west that is California. I mean, Colorado is actually really well regulated and very bureaucratic, but in California, it's chaos there. And there's a lot of people like my buddy from the book, Buttigieg, who is growing on a large scale under the guise of medical marijuana. He's not selling to dispensaries because he's not making enough money there. Mm-hmm. He's having people like myself cart it across the country and sell it in states like Indiana and Illinois, in places where the laws are much more stringent and therefore the profits are much higher. But the fact is that it's just we have a massive, massive supply in America. It is really not difficult to find. There's also it's 40% of the Mexican drug cartel's profit. So that's a lot of money. I mean, I personally thought that most of the drug cartel's profit was cocaine and crystal meth, because it doesn't smell and it's sort of easy to transport, whereas marijuana is bulky and it smells. But in fact, they're getting tons and tons of marijuana into the country. And so I really do think that the closer, you know, as the Mexican sort of drug wars there continue to rack up casualties, and as America continues to realize that this contradiction of the federal government listing it as a Schedule I drug that has absolutely no medical benefits and is among the most lethal drugs out there, with the fact that it's actually just a plant that I could, you know, grow in my living room by getting a seed, that hypocrisy at some point is going to reach a critical mass. And I think that's coming, because if you look at all the different – there's so many states right now that are following these medical marijuana states because they're finding that these states are getting a lot of tax – a lot of tax dollars in their coffers from these laws, and it's a way of controlling something that is otherwise basically just putting a lot of people in jail.
So let's say it does become legal. Do you figure it will become kind of a corporate product?
Once again, that gets into something where all these, you know, the sort of pro-pot people and the sort of hippie growers in Northern California are very, very paranoid that I heard a lot of stories when I was in Northern California, Humboldt County and Trinity County in the Emerald Triangle, where they said, oh, look at that hill over there. That was purchased by R.J. Reynolds, you know, the tobacco companies. And Starbucks has bought land over here because they're planning on I think there's something to be said for that. I mean, I think if it proves that it can make money and if the laws come around to the point where it's anyone's game, I mean, American history and certainly recent history points towards this sort of Starbucksization of marijuana. But at the same time, I think that would be a shame, and I think what's going pretty well in some of these marijuana states like Colorado is that they're continuing to – everyone's a little afraid of some giant warehouse full of weed. Right. So they are continuing to kind of keep it on relatively modest scales. There's marijuana is such a connoisseur's drug now in these medical marijuana states. I mean, these guys are serious botanists who grow this drug. This plant, and they it's not everyone can do it. So basically, there is still at this point, and I think going forward, it's going to stay this way for a while. There is still a sort of smaller community of botanists, and there tend to be sort of hippie people who believe in keeping things sort of artisanal, and they're the type of people who drink who take wine seriously and take craft brews and beer seriously. Yeah. And I think that sort of sensibility will continue until it becomes absolutely federally legal and regulated on a really grand scale. And then who knows?
So what happens to usage? I mean, you talk about in the book, you figure it'll spike for a bit. But once the novelty wears off after a while, where do you think we'll end up in terms of how many people use pot?
The United States of Amsterdam, right?
Yeah.
Pot nation.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it will. I think there's a pretty solid contingent of people who just really don't particularly have any interest in it and don't really have or at least don't think they have the urge to have that sensation, that sort of mind-altering sensation. And might feel a little out of control with it and might have experienced some of the paranoia. So I think there's a lot of people that it really won't affect them, and they'll continue to drink alcohol and use other the sort of standard and drugs that we've had in America. But I do think that there will be a contingent of people who for the first time will try it because it's finally legal, and will probably realize that they like it. And I'm hoping that for most of those people, it ends up being a positive experience and something that they can do in moderation and control. And I do think that after the initial sort of rush of it, I think that the usage will die down, because if you go to, for example, if you go to Amsterdam, you go to pretty much all of Holland, there's actually a pretty big stigma against it, because what ends up happening and what very well could happen here is you forget about not just marijuana being legal, but then there's marijuana tourism. Yeah. And Colorado and Washington are already dealing with this, where people from other states, from other countries are coming to Colorado and Washington strictly to buy marijuana and to be able to smoke it legally. What happens then is there's a little bit of a backlash against that. I mean, I have some Dutch friends. And almost none of them smoke because they associate it with these sort of
the losers in the cafe or something.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's these sort of wild-eyed Americans who come there just to get stoned out of their gourds. A lot of British people, they say, come there. And in general, just a lot of tourists come in, who are sort of the negative cliche of of marijuana that come in just to just, you know, sort of get blitzed out of their gourd in the same way that, you know, it's sort of like binge drinking. And then there's a little bit of a backlash against it. And I think just it also just becomes less novel. I think there's you know, probably a decent amount of people that kind of enjoy a little bit of the illicit element of it too, you know, the fact that they have a dealer and you have to sort of, you know, you have to sort of have a little code with him and do, you know, and you get to sort of meet up with like-minded friends, but you have to do it in sort of, you know, remote spaces. I think that making it legal kind of takes a little bit of the edge off of it. And after the initial rush, I think that they'll probably level out and maybe even over time usage and acceptance of it will sort of taper off.
It seems like the takeaway for you in the book is even if we do legalize marijuana, we're not going to resolve much of anything. I mean, we're still going to have a pretty conflicted relationship with it, I guess.
Exactly. I think that's exactly the case because, you know, in the same sense that, you know, I was sort of hoping slash planning that in the end I would decide that I no longer needed or wanted marijuana.
Right.
That didn't happen.
Yeah.
I probably use it quite a bit less than I did when I first started the book. Just I think, frankly, it's a little bit of what I just said. It's just, I was so exposed to it that it gets a little you just sort of get over it.
Mm-hmm.
But I still enjoy it. I still think it's a fantastic plant, and it's done some great things for me. It still has the ability when I'm really stuck in my head and in a really negative space and really, you know, worried about the mundane issues of my life. I can vaporize. I really don't smoke very much anymore, but I'll vaporize and I've got a fresh new perspective. And I think that, you know, that's good for me because I'm someone who's really been self-aware about it and really battled it. But I have also had some really difficult times, and I've had times where, as I said in the book, my plans didn't meet my execution, and I didn't get a lot of things done. And I think there's a lot of people in Marijuana Anonymous and things like that that still have these problems, and I think that just because it's legal will not kill these problems, and we need to address them regardless of whether it's legal or not.
Ryan Nurz, he's the author of the book Marijuana America, One Man's Quest to Understand America's Dysfunctional Love Affair with Weed. Ryan, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you. It was excellent.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.